This episode of Humans of Email is sponsored by AWeber, a tool for newsletters, landing pages, AMP emails, and more. Available for free at aweber.com/humansofemail. Start your next idea with AWeber.
What a special time of year this is.
It's Valentine's Day. Will you be mine, Natalie?
I will be your Valentine. I do like cherry cordials. I should let you know if you're going to send me one.
The cherry cordials, like sometimes they have like a cream and sometimes they have like a gel. Like they're either whitish or clearish, but always with a pink tinge inside of the chocolate.
I love them all.
Okay, well then dark chocolate or light chocolate?
Dark chocolate, lots of sugar. That's how I like my Valentine's days. But we're here to talk about a different kind of love letter.
We are. This is our love letter to the email community.
I'm so excited to share it. Will they be ours too?
Yeah. Hey, you're listening to this podcast. Do you maybe want to be our Valentines? Because that would be cool. I feel like there's a lot of love in the email industry.
There's so much love. And I'm really excited actually to share a lot of the stories that we have upcoming. We have so many good stories and so many fun conversations that are not just about email.
So we've been working on this podcast idea for ages on the DL, but I broke the silence. Last month at the Unspam conference, I showed up with a big stack of brand spanking new Humans of Email stickers and just kind of like dropped them on all of the swag tables and handed them out to friends and strangers and dropped the news. So I guess we have to actually make this thing happen now. We're committed.
It's happening. It's happening. It's happening right now. People are listening and it's happening right now. And some of the things that I know we've already talked about that they don't know we've talked about that I'm really excited for them to hear are not just about email. So some of the conversations that you're excited about, I know I can't wait for the Mothman episode.
Yes, the Mothman. And also the one about pollinators.
Yes. And mentorship. There's so many great conversations about how people got into the roles that they're in and who helped them along the way.
Side hustles and interests. There are a lot of people in our industry who are not just creators of email campaigns, but creators of other things in their lives. It's kind of a recurring theme.
Yeah, so fun to hear all of the creative ways that people who are in email are exploring other types of hands-on creativity. So that's going to be really fun to hear from too.
Yeah, because this isn't just a podcast about email marketing. This is about what makes us human and who we are also outside of email. And our tagline, it's the people, ideas, and accidents that drive email forward. And it's a podcast about us, the weirdos and misfits of the email industry.
And mistakes, of course, you mentioned. We have many, but they're fun. They're playful mistakes.
We are saving our mistakes episodes for, it'll be the fourth episode and then the eighth episode and then the 12th episode. So it's people and ideas that we're going to be talking about this and the next two episodes. You described us once as a grab bag in the marketing industry.
I think what I said is I feel like in email, we're like the people who no one could find a natural fit for in all the other parts of marketing. And they were like, have you tried email? And then, you know, those of us who stuck around were like, yes, this is it. This is me. This is where I fit. At least that was the case for me.
Absolutely. Definitely the case for me, too. I didn't even know that email was a job that you could just do. Just only do email. And one day that was my job, to only do email after kind of dabbling in it for years and years and years. And this is the 20th anniversary of my first email campaign, 2022. So, wow, I'm like email geriatric.
You've still got lots of good ideas. Are you ready to get this thing started? Are you ready for our first guest?
I'm so ready. This is season one. This is episode one. We don't know what we're doing, but yeah. I'm ready to get started.
I'm calling in from a blanket fort. I'm ready.
I'm ready too.
Let's do it.
Hi, Hello, everyone. Welcome to Humans of Email, a podcast about the people, ideas, and accidents that drive email forward. I'm Natalie Jackson.
And I'm Jen Capstraw. And today we're interviewing an email marketing pioneer. And I know he's way too humble to accept that compliment. He's one of the best known experts on interactive email. He's a software engineer at Salesforce, a member of the AMP for Email Working Group, a regular speaker at email events, and an absolute legend. It's a big Humans of Email welcome to Mark Robbins. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Yeah, that was quite an intro, wasn't it? Thank you.
I know how it feels to be on the other end of that, but you totally deserve it. back in 2015, you gave a presentation that people are still talking about, and it has cemented your place in email history. Can you tell our listeners what the topic of that was and why it was such a big hit?
Okay, so yeah, I did a talk on interactive email in 2015. I did it a few places. I think first was at a Front Trends conference in Poland, and then the Email Design Conference in London, which is now called Litmus Live. So it was about interactive email, and which was a very sort of new topic at the time. And I'd previously done a talk about a year before where I built a game, a little whack-a-mole game that you could play, and that only worked in Apple Mail. But here I was showing techniques that worked in a much wider variety of email clients and things that are a bit more sort of suitable for production and that we could actually use, rather than a game is quite a big project but not really much support and a very specific use case. But looking at things that are a bit more like image galleries, accordions that could actually serve a purpose in most email marketing. And with that as well, we'd built a fully functional checkout in email, and you could click through. You had it's like a shopping cart, and you could add and remove products to the cart. You can click on a product and it'll effectively load a separate page, although it's still in one email. It looks like it's loading a separate page. You can change the size and the color of the product, and then you could select your address and your credit card. And this is sort of the idea, was the credit card's already on file with the company you're buying from. So it'd be what the last four digits of your card is. Do you want to use card ending 1234 or card ending 5678? And then you submit that and it'll purchase things. It was only a proof of concept, but it had all the functionality built there. And that was sort of quite a big sort of introduction to interactive email. And at the end of the presentation, I revealed to everybody that I was presenting the whole thing from within an email, which people seemed to really love. And I was really happy with myself when I came up with that idea. So it looked like throughout the presentation, it looked like it was in PowerPoint or Keynote or something. But then at the end, I showed that this is actually all coming from Apple Mail. So, people seem to take that quite well. And still gets mentioned now.
Yes, it's legendary. And I saw it when you presented it the following year in 2016. I was at that same conference and I was also a speaker, and I was trying very hard to be memorable at this event. So I worked a chlamydia joke into my presentation, which led to me no longer presenting on behalf of my company anymore. But it did work, because one person said to me years later, I was there. I was nice. There. I remember the chlamydia joke. But did not cement me as a legend in the same way that your far more memorable presentation was, like the big reveal. Like, it just zoomed out and it's like, oh, this is actually an email. It was mind-blowing.
It's funny because that part of it, the sort of putting it into an email, because I was only doing it in Apple Mail and I was only doing it for the presentation, it's not being sent out anywhere. That was the easiest part. That's the easiest bit of the code. That's the simplest part of what I was showing, but it's the most memorable bit. It's the bit people really sort of focus on, which is quite cool.
I think you probably both got gasps, but for totally different reasons.
For those in our audience who didn't quite grasp what it means for an email to be interactive, or what AMP for Email is, you've kind of alluded to it a little bit. There were like transactional elements in this email. Mm-hmm. Can you give like the high level explanation of what that means?
So the definition I use for interactive email is it's an action taken in an email that triggers an event without leaving that email. So traditionally with an HTML email, you click on something and that's a link and you go through to a website and then you can do stuff. So it's bringing all that stuff that you'd normally do on the website into the email, or at least some of it. So it's putting the sort of the landing page into the inbox. So things like you have a image gallery and you can click a thumbnail and it changes the image, or have an accordion, so you click a title and it expands out and you have more detail below. And things like that, which are very common design patterns that you see on the web, but it's not something that comes up in email very often.
And people are excited about this ability to create interactivity, but adoption is low. And AMP for email, specifically one of the ways that you can achieve this, there's a lot of mixed sentiment toward this technology in the industry. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, being part of the working group, obviously I'm very much in favor of it. But so the way AMP for email works is it's a separate MIME type. So traditionally when we're sending our emails, we're sending a plain text version and an HTML version. Not everybody realizes you're sending a plain text version, but it's quite often handled by the ESP. They'll take the content out and create one and send it for you. So you will be sending a plain text and an HTML version. AMP is creating a third version, a third MIME type that we're adding in. So one of the things that holds people back is that now you have to create this extra version, which it is a bit more time consuming to create that. But then with AMP, you can do so much. Like the interactivity that I mentioned before, you can do all of that with AMP, but also you can do a lot more. You can do live content, so you can pull in a live data stream and put it into the email and put that content and display that content in the email. You can submit a form. You can submit a form from an HTML email, but with AMP, you can submit a form and get a response back into that email. So there's loads of things that are now possible by using that. And there's so many use cases, and even the most advanced examples of AMP that I've seen at the moment are really just doing very, very simple things compared to what is possible with it. It's such a huge technology, and I think it could be big. But yeah, it's slow taking off. I think if I was to be critical, I think there was a bit of an issue with the launch of it. Because they talked about it. It's like, look at all this cool stuff you can do. But actually, there wasn't much support in terms of sending AMP email at that point. So it's like, oh, great, this is brilliant. But there's no tools to help me build AMP. There's no ESPs that let me send AMP. So actually, it was just a concept at that point. But now, these are all building. It's Salesforce, we launched support for AMP, I think it was about this time last year. January 2021, I think. And more and more ESPs are adding it all the time. There's more tools being available, lots of companies building tools for it. In terms of creating the second version of an email, I did a video, part of the Trailhead Live series for Salesforce about how to sort of introduction into AMP emails. And one thing that you can do with AMP is you've got all these validation tools built in. Really good validator. So it part of that video I did, I took an HTML email, dropped it into the AMP validator, flagged up all the issues because it's not valid, it's an HTML email, changed them all, and then it's suddenly a valid AMP email. It took me about 3 minutes to do that. Like, it was a simple email, and I know HTML and know AMP, so it was probably quicker for me than it would be for some people, but still, it doesn't take very long to do that. And then once you have that and you have this valid code, then you can start enhancing it and just add a couple of enhancements. So I don't think it takes as long as people think to create AMP. So I'm hoping, we are seeing more adoption, we are seeing it build, but it should start slowly ramping up soon, I'm hoping.
Yeah, and more email editors are offering that AMP functionality to just make it drag and drop. We actually picked our email service provider for Humans of Email because they support AMP. It's AWeber, and it was the only entry-level small business solution that offered that capability. So we were like, well, let's play with it. Let's try it out.
Oh, brilliant, yeah. I look forward to seeing some AMP emails coming from you then.
Maybe we can do like a little interactive quiz. Like, is Mark Robbins A, legend, B, a pioneer, C, a humble guy, D, all of the above? Look for that in your inbox.
So Mark, over in B2B land here, we talked a little bit about obviously user adoption being kind of low. It's almost, I would probably argue, non-existent in B2B land. But there's a ton of value for B2B, I think, in like considering barriers to conversion. In my experience, one of the most common things that B2B email marketers are challenged with is that there are just so many barriers in the way of someone just getting to the contact form and saying like, hello, yes, I would like to be in touch, right? Like, we overthink the process of engagement with people exponentially in B2B land. Do you see any potential for B2B marketers to use AMP? I mean, some of it is, I think, like a platform problem, but I'd love to know your thoughts on where that's going for us B2B marketers.
Yeah, so currently AMP is supported in Gmail, Yahoo, AOL, mail.ru. B2B, I don't know the break, you'll know better than I do the breakdowns, but I think there's still a lot of Outlook usage.
Sadly, yes.
But Google Workspace, I think, has probably got quite a good share as well. So you can definitely use it for those customers. We're hoping to see more adoption. With Outlook, the Outlook desktop app on Windows, the one we all know about that causes the issues, I don't think that's ever going to have AMP. But there is more movement over into sort of online solutions. So actually going to outlook.com or like the Outlook 365 version online, which is the same as outlook.com. And if they were to pick up AMP again, then that would definitely increase the support in the B2B. And as more and more businesses moving more things online, that also would help. So I think it's going to be slower, but I think there are definitely some opportunities there.
That's true. A lot of us are still struggling to get video to play and email over in B2B land. So I would love to put a form in a B2B email. That would be amazing. That's really interesting. And I'd love to see more platform support. But you're right. I think that desktop version of the Outlook that we all know and love is a bit of a complication. I'd love to know, just taking a step back, how did you get into email marketing in the first place? What brought you to the point where you're a legend in this space?
So, I didn't study email. I didn't do years of studying email at school, unfortunately. I went to film school and when I came out of that, I was working in the industry for a while, doing mostly music videos. But I wasn't really making any money out of it. And it came to a point where I needed to really sort of commit into it and to move to London to sort of get some more education, actually get a qualification as an electrician as well, because I was working mainly in lighting department. And I just didn't want to do that. And it's so much of a lifestyle. So I decided I would start looking at other things. And I met a couple of guys outside a pub, which is how many of my stories start. And got chatting, and they gave me a job doing data entry in their company. From there, I worked in that company for a few years, and they sent me on a course to learn HTML and CSS, so I could start then doing more things and doing updates to the website and start getting into a bit of the marketing side of things there. Unfortunately, I got made redundant from that company. There was a bit of an issue. We reported certain companies in the travel industry for price fixing, and as a backlash for that, they may have put pressure on hotels and on price comparison sites to stop working with us. So but you know, may have, I don't know, I don't want to get into legal issues here, but yeah, so that I was unemployed then for about 6 months, just looking for work. And then guitarist from my band got me an interview at the company he was working at, working in the marketing team. And part of the interview, they said, oh, so you've done HTML and CSS. Can you build email? I said yes. I had no idea how to do it, but I said yes. So they gave me a design. I went home. I coded it up. I sent it over to them. Like, yeah, it's really good. Like, is it? I don't know. And so I started working there, and I was there for a bit. And then sort of started getting into email. And like one of the things that really sort of that changed it for me and made me look into email a lot more is there's all these rules about, oh, you can't put a background image in an email. You can't use like bullet lists in an email. I was like, okay, fair enough. I accepted this. But then I realized actually you can, and you can do these things, and you can do a lot more. But there's just like there's exceptions around it. You can do this, but it won't work in these certain places, or you need to do these fallbacks. So I started to sort of question a lot more of the rules and a lot more of the things around it. Actually, I found out there's a lot that you can do in email. And then I found this article on Campaign Monitor about, I think it was progressive disclosure, they called it. And it was a little accordion. You hover over something and then it expands out and shows more content. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. So I started playing around with that and then started building a few things. What can I do with this? So I built some games. The first one I did was a little fly flying around in the email, just using a bit of CSS animation. And if you hover over it, it squashes it and it just splats it. And it was.
That is amazing. I wish I could see that email.
I've still got the code, but the images have gone. And unfortunately, because I spent ages doing this little fly, it was a GIF that that was flapping. And then when you hovered over it, it was a sprite. So it just moved the background image. And then it had a little blood splatter with a twitching leg. It was quite graphic.
That's amazing.
We like gory things, both of us. So
yeah. And then from there, I built like the second game, which is still around, which is a Thwackavol for copyright reasons. It was called Thwackavol. And you had a little vole and a mole. And if you hit the vole, you scored a point. If you lost a hit the mole, you'd lose a point for copyright infringement. and that was, yeah, and you sort of score, I think, 4 points, and then then you get a message saying you've won. And that was just a little concept. And so from there, I was just sort of getting into this interactive email stuff, and just as it was sort of building up and a few people doing some cool stuff. And I saw an article about a company over in Washington, D.C. that had just raised some funding to do a checkout in email. And I was like, oh, that looks really interesting. So I shared it on Twitter. And so I got 3 likes on Twitter. 2 of those likes were from the 2 founders of the company. So I got in touch and I sent a message, I think via Twitter, and I said, oh, I love what you're doing. This looks really exciting. I built this the other day, this little Thwackavol game. Check it out. And he said, oh yeah, I stumbled across that the other day. I really like it. It's great. Here's my email. Let's chat. And we started chatting, and then ended up being the first employee at Rebel Mail, which was pretty cool. And then from there, I went over to DC for a month to meet the team, meet both the founders, and start working on stuff, and then came back to the UK where I am still, and working with them remotely. And the company built up, and end of 2018, we got acquired by Salesforce, and that's where I am now. So it's just, all of just stumbling into things, really. Yeah.
I'm a fellow art student turned email geek as well. I was a fiction writer.
Oh, brilliant.
And stumbled into email in a similar fashion, where it was like, well, I think I probably should do something other than fiction writing for a living.
Is it one of those things that's like, oh, actually, I need to earn some money?
Yeah, right. Turns out I'm not Stephen King. I thought maybe there would be some hope there, but I had to make a living in addition to writing novels. Yeah. So sadly, had to turn off that arts degree for a little bit. But I do think that there's some value in like having an arts background when you're talking about like email. I don't know. What do you think?
I think so. I think like having like that creative side and like thinking outside the box and being able to, and as well, like sort of from film or from fiction writing, you're telling a story, and actually that's quite often what you're doing with marketing as a whole. You're telling a story, you're trying to sell things to people, I guess, with a story of how you can relate to it. And I think I think there's definitely lots of areas of the creative side of it that overlap.
Yeah, I love that. I actually totally agree with you on the storytelling, right? Like, I mean, what is the customer journey other than like a narrative arc?
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. I think it's like kind of a question of like, whose narrative arc are you in? Like, is it your company's narrative arc, or can you insert yourself into like your actual prospect's narrative arc? Like, what is it that they're looking for? I love thinking about like the storytelling elements and how they apply to just marketing overall. But then like, you're right. You've got, I mean, you look at it like a general email, you could have anything from animation, like you're talking about, to graphic design, to copywriting, to, I mean, like these are all the arts degrees, right?
Yes, so exactly.
This is my plug for arts majors. Keep going. We'd love to find you an email. So I have two little kids. And the other day we were watching some sort of sporting event and like the Salesforce characters popped up on screen and they were like, oh, the Salesforce characters, like they actually know them. And I thought that was so funny. Wow. I was like, wow, what must it be like to work for a brand recognizable by 7-year-olds? So I'd love to hear, like, what's it like working for Salesforce?
It's big. It's a big company. I'm not sure what it is now. I think we're probably 60, 70,000 people in the company. Like going to the Dreamforce conference, it's like 200,000 people. It's huge. And there's, pros and cons to that. I think like it's just having like this massive network around and this support and being able to sort of like contact all these specialists in all these different areas is great. But also it sort of slows things down. It's hard to move. It's hard to turn a big ship. Whereas Rebel, we were 16 people, I think, something like that. And then it's from 16 to 60,000. It was quite a jump, quite a hiring boom, I think, as we looked at it. it's a big change, but it's fun. And I like to be able to sort of go around and going to the conferences and doing the big ones that Salesforce put on. It's quite an event.
Yeah, I've got that on my list of events to attend. I'm new to Salesforce. I've been Microsoft Dynamics my whole career. So I found you on Trailhead. I'll have to friend you whatever the appropriate nomenclature is.
You've been listening to Humans of Email, and we'll be right back.
All right, it's that part of the podcast, Natalie, where we talk about our sponsor, our platinum sponsor, AWeber, who is the official email service provider of Humans of Email. Now, you took on the job of trying to figure out what our email service provider was going to be when we were kicking around this idea.
Yeah. Okay. First of all, I just have to say how much I love learning new email platforms. Like, it's so much fun. I love it. I love seeing like how the different email platforms do the various things that they can do. And they always have features that like this one has that the other ones don't have. So that's been really, really fun for me as I jump in to geek out about the cool stuff that I've found in AWeber so far. I mean, I think this was really a relationship that started with the Email Geeks channel, where I put out a just general call to say, hey, who's got any ideas or recommendations for a really strong email platform that would work great for people like us who were email geeks, but also like didn't have a huge budget to get started, but needed a lot of cool features. And I know that they definitely delivered on that.
Yeah, you narrowed it down to two and you were like, Jen, I can't decide which one's it going to be, option A or AWeber. And I think it took me 5 minutes to go, oh, AWeber supports AMP for email? I want to try that out. Like,
how cool is that? I know. Like, how cool is that?
Yeah, it's the only entry-level solution that is offering support for AMP for email. And it's something I'm very curious about. It's something I've been talking about for ages. So to have that hands-on experience with it is going to be very cool. I don't know what our AMP campaigns are going to be just yet, but like, we're going to learn. We're learning a lot along the way. And the team has been incredible to work with so far. We didn't even know anybody there. We were just like, hey, want to sponsor our podcast? You probably don't know us. And it was so awesome. They were like, yes, we would love to take this chance with you. So Thanks, Team AWeber.
And they've been great with support too, helping us figure out the new features, even like with the WordPress plugin. Like, they've got an awesome WordPress plugin, and they were super great to help us like know the best uses and practices for that. So I've been really excited to work with them on not just like getting in there and getting hands-on, which is like super easy in that platform, but also reaching out to them for best use cases, for making sure that I'm doing things the right way. They've been so responsive. That's been really cool.
Big thanks, AWeber, platinum sponsor of Humans of Email Season 1. And you'll be learning lots about what we're learning along the way.
Can I say I'm amped up? Is that too obvious?
I mean, it's corny and I support it.
Great.
And if you'd like to give AWeber a try, you can check them out for free at aweber.com/humansofemail. That's AWEBER.com/humansofemail.
I'd love to know too, you talked about this a little bit, Mark, with being in a band.
Yes.
But what are some other things that people would not necessarily know just from your professional email presence? Like, what are some passions, some other hobbies, some side hustles, quirks, What else are you into other than email?
That music is a big thing. I'm a bass player, but play a bit of drums, a bit of guitar as well. And I make instruments. I've built a few guitars, built an amplifier, some effects pedals, and just sort of trying to learn into that. And then also along those lines, I'm starting building bits of furniture as well. I built a nice cabinet the other day, which it's just, I like working with like very manual things outside of work. So actually, getting my hands dirty with like some like woodwork, some carpentry, some joinery, and that side of it is good. It's sort of a good detox from all the digital sat at the computer stuff that I do. And also, with the music, sort of picking things up and like physically touching things is something I really miss when I'm working on the digital side of stuff. And aside from that, I'm a big foodie. I worked as a chef for a bit as well. So worked in a wine merchant for a bit. So food and wine are big for me. I cook a lot. My dad's a chef as well. He's a brilliant chef and does sort of paella parties as his business, but also cooks all sorts. And so very much inside. There's a great food scene where I am in Brighton. There's so many good restaurants. It's a lot of fun.
So those actually all feel very related to me. I don't know if you feel like that, Jen. Like, they're all very related, like very detail-oriented construction type activities that result in something really beautiful in the end.
You're a creator. So whether it's digital or physical, like that's a satisifying process is what it sounds like to
me.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't always result in something beautiful, but sometimes it does when it works out.
So you are incredibly passionate about sharing knowledge and being a very generous contributor to the email community. Let's talk about that. I feel like there was kind of a shift maybe like 5 to 7 years ago from like information being kind of closed to a sharing and a better sense of community in the email industry.
Yeah, I think like for me when I was starting out, I learned a lot from sort of the community, from blog posts, particularly like Campaign Monitor and Litmus, and I learned a lot from there. And I sort of, it's nice to be able to sort of like put something back, and it really helped me. So I know how useful it is to have these things. And I've been through all these questions. I've hit all these bugs. I know how frustrating it is to try and work these things out. I like to really share it. I think as a community as a whole, I think we are very good at sharing now. And I have sort of seen that change. And it's something I think the web industry did very well. And we've sort of, I think, taken influence from that to an extent. I think now we do a much better job of sharing than the web industry does. There's still a lot of conflict in web, but actually within email, it's very collaborative. Like open source projects are great to sort of get stuck into. And I advise anybody, if you like, go and help out with some stuff. For me as well, the best way to develop my knowledge on something is to try and sort of explain it to others. So if I find something like, you know, particularly a bit of code or something, it's like, oh, here's a little code trick and this works. But then if I then go and put it into a presentation or write an article about it, I then look through it line by line and I feel I need to justify every part of that. I need to understand it. I need to understand the how and why is this working when the other parts aren't working. And that really helps develop my knowledge. And then so I know a lot more. And then but I only do that from sharing it. So I think it's definitely it's good and it helps everybody. The better, the more knowledge that we have as a community, the more that everybody has. So I'll share something, somebody else will share something, someone else will share something, somebody else will take all those pieces, put them together and come up with something new. And then now we've all learned something, we've all benefited from that.
I think it's what really makes our community special. It's warm and fuzzy.
It really is, isn't it?
It is. And that's what like really prompted us to create this show, to like really celebrate that sense of community and the people who make it up. Something that I have heard through the grapevine and that you have since confirmed, you're dyslexic.
Yes.
And you have told me and you've told some others in the industry that that is a good thing in many ways. It's what makes you good at your job. Can you explain how that is? Why is that?
Yeah, so sort of dyslexia, it's different. Everybody who's dyslexic is different. And this is, it's an important thing to remember, like when you're sort of talking about people with whatever it is, whatever sort of neurodiversity or any kind of disability or any kind of anything like that makes us different. It's every individual is different. So dyslexia is something, it definitely used to be called a learning difficulty. These days it's more referred to as learning difference. And there's a big jump there. I think it's always a learning difference, but for some people, in sort of some cases where it can actually be a difficulty as well. But it means my brain is wired in a slightly different way. So I think about things differently, and that is an advantage. Somebody I know once explained it as it's like being left-handed. You're absolutely fine. You can do everything that somebody right-handed can do. It's just the world is mostly built for people who are right-handed. And so you have to work around. You have to find these workarounds, or you get until there's more education around and people realise that this is an issue that we need to think about. It's a logic thing. So I struggle a lot with reading, with spelling and that sort of stuff. And it's the rules of words, the rules of spelling don't add up. I think it's particularly bad in English, as it is with other languages that have a lot of influences from different languages. Like English is made up a lot of sort of old English, as big German influence, big French influence, big Latin influence. So you've got all these different rules coming in of how you spell things, and it's not consistent. So I had a tutor outside of school who was absolutely brilliant, and she's the one who sort of diagnosed me as dyslexic and sort of explained to me how these things work. And she said, oh yeah, so here's the rules of spelling. And actually when there's some rules, I could understand a little better. And then she said, but sometimes there's the exceptions that you just have to know them. You can look into the entomology of the word and you can understand why something's different, but why is this word spelt with a sort of German heritage, whereas this word, which is very closely related to it, has a French heritage? So, well, that makes no sense. Or these two words that sound the same are spelt completely different. And sort of trying to get those rules to make sense didn't, but there's lots of little workarounds that help with that. So if we translate all of that into writing code, code is logical, code makes sense. If I say something is 20 pixels, it's 20 pixels across the board, except maybe in Outlook, because, you know, Outlook. But I've already learned these things. I've learned how to make exceptions, how to do workarounds for certain things, how to get by when there are these exceptions. And the exceptions of email clients, like messing stuff up, are much more logical than the exceptions of language and spelling. And so actually, taking it from that point, I've already developed these skills, like from childhood, of how to work around these problems when the logic doesn't make sense. So I feel like I can apply them that way. And that's how I think it works. It's just particularly just it's my brain processes things in a different way to some other people's brains. And that is a benefit to me.
I got my own late in life neurodivergent diagnosis, and it explained a lot.
Mm.
But I agree. It has allowed me to see the world through a different lens, to challenge, you know, what is largely accepted, to solve problems. And I feel like it's a big advantage. It's been a disadvantage in some ways as well. I can see the ways that it's had a negative effect on my career. But largely, I feel it's an advantage. And last year, I interviewed several individuals in the email space who are dyslexic, ADHD, they have dyspraxia, autism, and every single one of them had the same answer to the question, you know, if you could not be this way, if you could make this go away, would you? Every single one of them said no. I like who I am, and I like the way it helps me do my job. I like this part of me. And I thought that was pretty terrific. And so DEI has been a huge topic in tech and corporate world, and there's some conversation about it in the email industry. Do you think that companies should be addressing neurodiversity as a part of their DEI initiatives?
Absolutely. I think it's a huge benefit to companies. Like sort of the whole sort of diversity as a whole, and it's just getting different viewpoints. So if you look at things like, I suppose what we more traditionally think about is like your race, ethnicity, sex, gender, sexuality, age, all these different things that we think about, these all account to different life experiences, and your different lived experiences make you approach things in different ways, give you different ideas. And I think the neurodiversity side of it is the way your brain is wired. That's how I think of it. And so that as well makes you think about things differently. I think having that range is so, so powerful. When you're particularly trying to do something creative, having all these different inputs and different ideas, it's great having a range of sources when you're trying to do something creative. When you're trying to problem solve, I think if you've got everybody is thinking the same way, you're going to hit the same problems, but you're going to fix a load of problems and miss a load of problems. If you've got everybody thinking in different ways and different sort of patterns to their thought processes, this is going to really help. So if you had, having this sort of range of people in your team is an incredibly powerful thing for a company to have.
I find that because email does require such a higher level of problem solving capacity, because we don't have standardization across our email clients and it is hard to do, I have a suspicion that there are a lot of neurodivergents in the email industry. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it could be. I think I've been reading up quite a bit about autism recently. My niece has just been diagnosed as autistic. And learning sort of bits around that and sort of looking at the special interest side of it. And I think a lot of people in our community sort of have that special interest. I certainly do, where you're really like looking at it and you get quite passionate about, a bit obsessed about email and how it all works. And I think that's definitely something that comes up. And I think actually also thinking from a business point of view, I think, like managing people, if you're a people manager, it's great to get all these people involved in your team, but also you need to adapt your management style to work with people like that. I have been very lucky. I'm always given every job I've had, pretty much. I've always been given a lot of freedom you need to do these things, but you can a bit of freedom about the approach of how to do it, and bit of time to research and develop new ideas, and given that freedom, and that really works for me. Other people it might not work for, but I think that's something that's key, is learning how to get the best out of people, sort of through their differences, and like everybody is wired differently, and understanding how to achieve that is a very big skill.
So just thinking a little bit more about the community, and to take us on a slightly different turn, are there some brands out there that you think are really inspirational that you follow and you think like, man, that brand is killing it with email?
Email Weekly from Action Rocket is always a joy. It's always a delight to open that. And they've got great content, great design, and always like trying out some cool code things in there as well. And it's for the email geeks. It's by the email geeks. It's going to be good. You always know that. And I think there's a lot of companies within the email world that are doing great stuff along those lines. Outside of email, I like what actually Google do a lot of good stuff. I think they do. They've been doing a few sort of shopping cart type emails with using AMP for email through the Google Store, and sort of with their Nest products and sort of the Pixel Buds. That was a good one for. Also with Google Docs, they're doing sort of the good stuff with integration with AMP. So you get a comment through and you can actually reply to it directly in the email. It's such a good sort of way of working. It really bothers me when I get a message from various social media or whatever it is saying, you have got a new message. It's like, great, but it doesn't tell me what the message is. That's really bad user experience. I have to click through, I have to log in, and then I have to see the message that just says, thanks. It's like, right, that it's just replying to something I just said, and that you it's wasted so much time. So having things like that is great user experience. And also sort of on the user experience side, I get like the monthly Google Maps update, and it says this month you have visited two new towns, you've walked however many miles, you've driven this far or whatever. I really like those. And again, from a user experience point of view, everything's in the email. I think a lot of the time people get too carried away with stats, and you know, email's primary function is to get users to click to the website. That's not true. I hate that. And that's not the purpose of your email. It's like, why are you sending this email? Oh, to get clicks. That's putting stats above users. Is it like, if you want to take a more corporate point, it's putting stats above sales or whatever as well. You could think of it that way too. And it's actually, what is the point of this email? What are we trying to do with it? And something like that, which is the Google Maps one, there's just a little bit of joy, a little bit of inspiration. It's just a fun thing they send out. And I don't need to click through. I just see it there, and that's cool. That's interesting. This is where I've been. This is what I've done. And I like things like that. I think that's definitely, I think they do a great job there.
I love that answer and wholeheartedly and enthusiastically agree with you that like the purpose of an email is not to generate clicks. And in fact, I know, Jen, you have a question specifically about that, so I'll let you take it up. But I love that. That's great.
And maybe you've already answered our next question, but it's like, what do you think is a common email mistake or a widespread email misconception that you wish marketers would correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one of them, like putting stats before users is something. But other things as well, like I do a lot of work around accessibility as well. And one thing that really bothers me is if people looking at their emails and getting really fixated over bugs, which be something that's a couple of pixels out in Outlook. It's like the design is a couple of pixels different. And it fails QA for that, but yet let all these big accessibility bugs slide. And if something's a couple of pixels out, but it's functional, it works. I think that's the priority. That's the priority we should be saying. Is something functional? Is the code functional? Can users use it? And if it passes that, then that's sort of your base level. And then you can start looking at design stuff. If it's not usable to some users, to any user, then you failed and you need to fix that. I think that's a big one, is sort of looking at that side of it. And along those lines as well, something which is it's a talk that I'm sort of putting together and hoping to do some point, maybe this year or some point soon, is looking at the way we approach building emails. most people, the majority of emails, people putting Outlook first. You're starting with a table-based layout, and then you have to work all these workarounds. Tables don't work very well in code. They're not, they don't work well for being responsive. So we have to then put all these workarounds to fix these bugs in every other email client because we're coding for Outlook. If we flip that around and we code semantic code first, and we make it good quality, accessible semantic code, and then we put in fallbacks, so we put in some ghost tables to make it work in Outlook, it, I just find that is much quicker, much easier, and far fewer bugs. It's a better way of working. So that's what I'm sort of, that's my plan for this year, is to maybe try and spend some time convincing people to change how they're thinking about how they approach writing code.
Most email marketers, though, they don't have that expertise in code writing, but they've got to bang out some emails anyway. What are some tips for them to apply that kind of thought?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And yeah, because I spend all my time in the code, I do focus on it a lot. But it's, you need some, like, some templates and some starting points. And I think everybody starts with, okay, let's build everything in tables and then work backwards. Just changing that starting point is the main thing. If you just build it like semantically and then put some tables in. Actually, from a semantic code point of view, if you can write Markdown, which a lot of people do these days, there's more and more things with Markdown. So, you know, if you put like a hash, then a line, then that's a title. If you put two hashes, then it's like an H2. And this is sort of how a lot of people write blog posts and stuff. It's how my website is built. And that's semantic code. If you can write all your content like that, if you can write it all out if you do it all in a document, do it in a Google Doc or something, if you can write your content like that, then you have your semantic structure pretty much straight away. Quite often you can get alt text that way as well. You just put a note saying image and then what you want that image to say and what that image, the message that's conveying. That's your alt text. From my point of view as a coder, that HTML is written by the copywriter. The CSS is written by the designer. I just sort of take what they have and then put it together, and it sort of translates what they have into it. But it's sort of the structure's already there. It's already written out for you. So I think, yeah, it's just sort of trying to change the thought process a bit of how you think about things.
You've got a website, goodemailcode.com. What can folks find there?
There you can find some good email code. It was I wasn't that imaginative with the name. Inspired by really good emails, I guess it sort of does what it says. So what I've done with that code, it's a lot of it is I had notes, and some of it in my head, some of it noted down in various places all over the place, and I just wanted to sort of organize my notes on how to do things, and but also share that and let people sort of use this. So I've taken sort of every part of an email, and I'm sort of, that's going through what is the basic template, and then taking that code of a basic template shell and then going through it line by line and explaining what each line of that code does and why it's there. By doing that, with all that explanation, it can help you understand if something's not working. You can maybe help that with debugging it. If something changes and it's like, this is a fix for this email client, and it's like, oh, that email client has now made a big update or no longer exists, then you know you can remove that, and it all sort of explains all of that. So looking at things like the outer shell of an email, looking at how to do text, how to do an image, how to do columns, how to do a CTA link, and how to do all these sort of basics, but also then looking at some more advanced stuff and sort of breaking it down so you can do, if you want to do some like CSS art, if you want to use SVGs, if you want to do something a bit more advanced, how you do that. And then looking at accessibility as well, like how can we respect the user preferences? So if a user says they want to use a large font size, how do we carry that through? How can we then implement that into our design and allow the user to change that easily? And so all of that, and it, yeah, just trying to sort of explain as much as possible. And I welcome comments and stuff as well. If anybody is using the code that I share and finds a bug, please let me know. I would love to fix as many as possible. If you're using it in email clients that I don't test on and I don't know about even, I would like, yeah, I want to make this as robust as possible. So people can go there. You can just copy and paste the code if you want to. You can read the full thing and understand it. But yeah, that's what I'm trying to do with that site.
Mark, I didn't even know you could use SVG images in email. I just learned something.
There's a few caveats around that, but yes, you can to some extent, yeah.
I look forward to looking at your site in greater depth as a complete non-coder. This is like great for me. I love it, but I'm very weak in the code. I can make bullet lists and set image width, and that's about it. So thank you.
No worries.
We have a lot to learn still. It's been ages since I've been hands-on in code, and even then it was just barely getting by, you know, just enough to like slap together the email and make it work.
Well, I think that's something that the industry seems to be evolving a bit into more specialist areas, because it feels like it used to be a lot more, you're the email person, you have to do everything. You have to be a designer, a copywriter, a strategist, a coder, everything you need to do. And it seems to be there is more sort of specialized areas that people are going into now, which I think is the way it needs to be, because it's each one of these skills is really complicated and is a really hard thing to master. So actually, if you can, having an understanding of as much of it as possible is good, but being able to specialize is, yeah, definitely a real strength.
Mark, it has been an incredible pleasure to have you here today. Thank you so much for joining our brand new podcast.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Where can folks follow you, find out more about your incredible expertise, see you speak, in addition to goodemailcode.com?
Yeah, that's goodemailcode.com. Also, I'm on the Twitters, m_j_Robbins. And I'm on the Email Geek Slack a lot, in the code channel, sharing my advice, even if it's not asked for. And I'm hoping to be back out and about on the conferences again, maybe this year, see what happens. But yeah, on restrictions and such. But yeah, hopefully I'll be traveling around again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mark. If you enjoyed today's show, this has been so great. Really appreciate you being our first guest. And I hopefully will meet you somewhere on the conference circuit. That would be great. If you enjoyed today's show, be sure to subscribe to our email list at humansofemail.com. Follow us on the socials. You can also send us an email at howdy@humansofemail.com. And thanks for being with us again.
Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Humans of Email, a podcast about the people, ideas, and accidents that drive email forward. An Idea Empire production. Copyright 2022.